This is Marketplace Money for the weekend of February 5th, 2010. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. Putnam, a world of investing.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is Marketplace Money. Toyota's advertising slogans took more than a few hits this week. Moving forward, whether you like it or not, I don't love what you do for me. Yeah, by now, you've no doubt heard about the 8-model and counting pileup and recall of Toyota vehicles. This week, the company's president publicly acknowledged the safety issues for the first time. We asked our friend Phil Reed of Edmunds.com to come in and tell us what Toyota's travails mean for owners and potential buyers. Welcome back, Phil.
Good to be here again.
So first the floor mats, then the gas pedals, now the brakes on the Prius. Would you buy a Toyota right now?
At the right price, I would. I mean, we're talking about problems which are very specific and small, although essential to the operation of the car.
Yeah, just a little.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons it's captured the imagination of people, and it's been so difficult for Toyota.
So almost 10 models are affected by all these issues. 8 of them have been taken off the lot. They're not for sale. But obviously, dealers need to move some inventory. So if you do decide to go ahead and buy a Toyota, you know, maybe based on years of reliability, is it a good time to do so?
Yes, it could be very good. You know, Toyota salesmen are starving out there. They love the feeling of foot traffic. They love the feeling of sales. I mean, they are so driven in the car business by sales today. That's sort of the lifeblood of the dealership.
So what's it like if you walk onto a Toyota lot right now?
Well, there's the service bay. Some of the service bays have been completely overwhelmed.
Yeah.
There's also a fair amount of confusion because they've had to pull a lot of inventory out or at
right.
least mark them as not being available for sale.
What about these incentives that are being offered by other car makers? GM, Ford, I think Hyundai was the first to say, hey, bring in your Toyota. We'll give you some cash back.
Right.
Should this sway your buying decision?
Well, it's $1,000 in some cases is about the maximum. It does have an effect, particularly because these types of incentives, which are called conquest incentives.
Conquest incentives.
Yeah, it's
nice. They could call it Schadenfreude, I think.
Exactly. But basically, it means if you have a Toyota, you want to shop for a Ford, you know, show them the registration on your current Toyota and they'll give you $1,000 off.
Mm-hmm.
The beauty of it is that it can be combined with other things in most cases. So you get $1,000 on top of whatever incentives, whatever good financing is available on the vehicle. So it's substantial, yes.
Now, what about the folks who currently have Toyotas? What does this do to the potential resale value of their cars? Does it have any sort of spillover effect?
What we saw initially was a 10% reduction in the amount that they could trade the vehicle in for. That was mainly at Toyota dealerships. We've had reports of a lot of people trying to turn in their Toyotas for trade-in at other dealerships, such as Ford's. And they're also being given very low trade-in values there and in some cases being discouraged and told to hang on to their cars for the short term. You know, now that you're in a very weak position, this is the worst time to trade in a Toyota.
How long do you think this is going to be sticking to the Toyota brand? Is it worth waiting 3-4 months to see if this blows over a little bit?
One of the things is that it appears that it's going to take about maybe 3 months, as long as 3 months, to fix all of the cars.
Mm.
And until that happens, we're going to be hearing about this. So I would say if you can wait, absolutely do wait. What most people don't realize is it doesn't stick quite as much as you might imagine. Looking back, you know, we have a number of historical cases. You know, we have the Ford with the Firestone tire problem.
Right.
We have Audi with sort of a similar sudden acceleration problem. We looked back at Ford data, and we couldn't actually see that their resale value dropped off at that time.
Really?
So it's kind of, you know, in our imagination, it's a very large problem. On the street where money is being transacted, it's not as big as that.
Phil Reed of Edmunds.com, thanks so much for coming in.
Pleasure to be here.
Throw a proverbial stone, and chances are you'll hit someone who's been downsized in this recession. Losing a job can be disastrous, but for some, it can also be an opportunity. According to the Kauffman Foundation, some of the country's biggest companies have their roots in recessions. Perhaps with that in mind, New York City has founded its first small business incubator. Ben Calhoun explains how it works.
If you spend time talking to entrepreneurs, you start to notice they share a special skill. When they introduce themselves, they have an ability to move from name to sales pitch so quickly, it's as if the two were physically attached. Let me just have you introduce yourself on tape.
Okay. Hi, my name is Joel Henry. We started the Fig Food Company. The objective of Fig Food is...
The Fig Food Company is a vegetable-based organic food company. Before starting it, Henry worked for almost 19 years in the corporate food world at places like Kraft, Campbell's Soup, and wine and spirit giant Diageo. The whole time, he fantasized about starting his own company.
I'm always trying to figure out what I wanted to do that was going to leave a legacy. That's always the piece that's been paramount in my mind.
And so when his job was eliminated a while ago, he thought, you know, if there were ever a time...
Now's the time. This is it. If I'm going to do it, this is the time.
Now he sits in a gray-walled cube on the 12th floor of a Manhattan office building, just a few subway stops away from Wall Street. He shares the floor with more than 20 other companies, picked by the city from 300 and some applicants. All of them are small startups, just like Henry's.
I'm the only full-time person in this initiative, so I'm relying...
I'm the only one.
It's just me.
Staff of one.
Staff of one.
The other companies in the incubator are all over the map. Green energy, social networking, job placement, custom clothing. But they all feel the same white-hot pressure to succeed. Long hours around here are the norm, but the undisputed long-hour champ seemed to be a film production company, started by three friends, Ori Gratch, Tim Hobbs, and Sophia Pandey.
I get emails from them at 1:30 a.m. sometimes.
Sometimes later.
Sometimes later.
For this film in particular, we were trying to coordinate between operations in London and in L.A., and since the time difference there is 8 hours, it got a little hairy.
This happened to be the morning after the company's first movie premiere.
I really thought I'd have to give Ori a sedative last night because I thought his head was going to pop off.
Despite the stress, everything went fine. So today the group is savoring the win with other companies in the incubator.
I would say close to a full house. Just about, yeah. So it felt great.
That's one of the best things about working here, people in the incubator say. There's a feeling of camaraderie. You get to share in people's successes and get support when things aren't going so well.
It's extreme highs and extreme lows. Like, even when things go good, you still have something coming on the corner that you're not quite prepared for.
Johnny Martiri used to work at Merrill Lynch. He and a few of his friends recently launched a website called Hotlist, which helps college students coordinate their social calendars.
Best day so far?
Well, we just launched yesterday. We did a soft launch to New York City.
So, best day yesterday.
Most frustrating day so far?
I think it would be today.
Martiri's problem is that his website is getting too popular too quickly, so his computer servers are overloaded.
You know, when you're getting to the 18 to 22 demographic, if it doesn't load in a second, they're not using it.
Martiri spent the day scrambling to find more server space and money to buy it, until he does. Polytechnic Institute of NYU, which runs the incubator, is stepping in.
NYU Poly has been generous enough to actually make donation of servers for us, so right now we're going to be working with their IT people. Because they know our budget, and these servers are very, very, very expensive.
Dollar-wise, New York City's not spending a ton on its incubator initiative. $100,000 on this one and $800,000 to put up 4 more. Still, those in charge have big hopes for the incubator. They hope it gives the city a chance to gain some ground on places like Silicon Valley and Boston. And they hope it can give a leg up to those who are trying to get a business off the ground during these tough economic times. As Johnny Martiri settles in for a late night trying to fix his server issue, it's clear he's hopeful too. In New York, I'm Ben Calhoun for Marketplace Money.
And this is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. You've been incubating your thoughts about our show, and boy, did you hatch them this week. First, to our conversation with author Lisa Dodson about her book, The Moral Underground. In it, she describes some of the ways that ordinary workers prop up the less than fortunate among us, from teachers who buy supplies for their students to managers who still pay an employee for the workday hour they missed to pick up a child. Many of you called that out as stealing and chastised us for not highlighting this side of the moral equation. Scott Broadfield in Mount Holly, North Carolina, says it's fine to help on your own dime.
If a manager feels that his employees are being underpaid, he is free to make up the difference from his own account.
But Jason Verne of Killeen, Texas, thought Dodson had a point about a moral underground.
At what point does an employer steal by taking advantage of workers with unfair pay and no benefits?
In that same show, we addressed yet another moral issue, or at least we asked whether it was even about morals. And this is the question of walking away from your mortgage. Here's a sample from our discussion.
Shatters your credit rating for 7 years. It's often a very bad business decision.
I don't care if it was a bad business decision. It's wrong.
Bonnie Pascucci of Billings, Montana, believes a mortgage is more than just a business agreement. It is a moral promise to pay.
You signed your name, giving your word that you would fulfill your part of the contract. How loud would we be screaming if the lending agency changed their mind?
But many of you agreed with one of our panelists who argued that individuals have no more obligation than a corporation does when entering into a contract. And businesses break contracts all the time, including in real estate. That panelist, by the way, provoked reactions beyond what he said on our show. A few of you pointed out that Henry Blodgett, the CEO of a website called The Business Insider, was banned from the securities business in 2003 because he publicly talked up stocks while recommending that his own firm steer clear of them. In recent years, Blodgett has earned a reputation as an insightful commentator, but we should have acknowledged his past, especially for this conversation. Our recent story about perma-renters asked whether more Americans are shrugging off mortgages altogether. The piece said one bright spot is that renters don't have to worry about property taxes. Ed Barna in Middlebury, Vermont, took issue with that assertion.
An owner's costs are routinely passed on in the form of rent increases, including tax costs. This is basic financial literacy. Tisk, tisk, tisk.
And finally, there was my recent trip to the movies. Well, not just the movies, but gold-class cinemas, where tickets cost $29. Lots of you were on the edge of your seat to hear if the fancy food and drinks I mentioned are included. Sadly, no, they are not. But I can recommend the homemade potato chips smothered in blue cheese and the signature rated R cocktail. What was I thinking when I paid for all that? Don't forget to write us the next time you hear a story about money and wonder, what were you guys thinking? Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Contact. A major career change usually takes a major commitment of time and money, but one company is training low-paid employees for better jobs.
What do I want to be when I grow up? People need a chance to go back to school and to get that second chance.
It's free and gets them better workers. We'll hear how it's done next up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. The job picture in this country is not getting a whole lot better. The unemployment rate did go down in January, but in a separate survey, 20,000 jobs dropped off the nation's payrolls. We're used to hearing that a good education is a ticket to a good job, but millions of Americans are stuck in what they feel are dead-end jobs because they can't afford a good education. But now, in a few places around the country, labor and management are working together to lift entry-level workers into skilled jobs. Lori Stern of American Radio Works has the story of one program in Washington State.
In suburban Seattle, Candace Picasso is a part-time housekeeper at a big hospital.
I like to have things very organized and just really kind of a neat freak.
She starts each day in the basement laundry room arranging her cart. She picks just the right rags from a bin and folds them neatly. 3 days a week, 6 hours a day, she'll dust, wipe, make beds, and empty trash.
Housekeeping.
Candace is 26. Her parents have factory jobs. Her husband works in a restaurant. In her family, graduating high school was a big accomplishment. Until recently, Candace never thought in terms of a career.
I started working and I met my husband and we had our baby and then my husband was goading me to get into a hospital. Or he's like, I'd love to see you as a nurse. I'm like, well, I guess we can try and get my foot in the door, you know, at least.
So as a part-time housekeeper, Candace has her foot in the door. And in lots of hospitals, it would be stuck there. The better jobs are taking care of patients and they require skills Candace doesn't have. She could learn them at community college, but she can't afford the tuition.
in this country, we're used to thinking that everybody has a chance to make it. But we aren't always used to thinking that everybody deserves a second chance to make it as well.
That's Laura Chenvin with the Healthcare Career Advancement Program, or HCAP. HCAP works with unions, employers, and states. The partners all put up cash and bend their rules a little so that healthcare workers like Candace can advance in their careers.
I think a lot of us, when we get to work, we kind of grow up there. We begin to see what we do and don't want to do. You know, what do I want to be when I grow up? Don't we ask ourselves those questions all throughout our life? People need a chance to go back to school and to get that second chance.
For Candace, the second chance came about a year ago in a notice stapled to her paycheck. It said she could become a personal care assistant by taking free college classes at the Union Hall and doing on-the-job training where she already works.
We go get vitals for a patient and then pass ice water, help them wash up for breakfast, order breakfast, and feed those who can't eat themselves, you know?
Hospitals have learned that it's better to promote from within because more than a third of recruits who come fresh from nursing school end up quitting in the first 2 years. Existing staffers like Candace are a better bet because they're used to the intensity of hospital work. HCAP runs programs in 8 states and says the labor management college idea is gaining ground despite the recession. Part of the impetus is that hospitals still need nurses. Jaime Garcia of the Washington State Hospital Association says many nurses are nearing retirement age, just as hospitals brace for an increase in demand.
You have the first wave of the baby boomers beginning to retire. Well, as the boomer generation ages, people over 65 use 3 times the amount of health care. That's why you still see towers being built at hospitals, in spite of the recession, because they have to get ready for the wave of people coming out.
Garcia says hospitals will get bigger and need more skilled workers, including nurses, than they can find. The hospital where Candace works is a good example. It's opening a new wing this winter.
I would like to call Norma Sanchez.
At a party at the Union Hall last summer, Candace Picasso and about 80 others celebrated the end of their first year of healthcare training. Candace's little daughter danced in the aisle, and her mother, Maria Hampshaw, sat beaming. Hampshaw never finished high school. Now her daughter is a college student.
We're just very excited for her that she's gone through this program and succeeded, and she's doing the right kind of job for her because she's so caring and loving and helpful and wants to help people all the time, so she's in the right field.
In September, Candace passed the certification test to become a personal care assistant. She'll be on the short list for one of 8 new full-time PCA jobs to be added when the new wing opens. If she gets the job, she'll also get a hefty raise and health insurance for her family. And she'll continue taking classes towards her goal of becoming a professional nurse. I'm Laurie Stern for Marketplace Money.
For those lucky enough to be going off to college, this is the time to be filling out lots and lots and lots of forms. And if you think doing your taxes is hard, try the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA. It's the key to getting a government grant or loan. Some schools do require additional paperwork, but the hunt for money starts with the FAFSA. There are free ways to get help, though, and maybe even raise your school spirit. From the Marketplace Education Desk, Caitlin Carroll reports.
College Go!
What you're hearing is a promotion for College Goal Sunday. It takes that kind of over-the-top enthusiasm to get students pumped to tackle financial aid. These events are rolling out across the country in YMCAs, churches, and schools to help students file their financial aid forms correctly and on time.
There are steps to take. There's a job to be done. I want step one, step two, step three spelled out.
Step one is signing up. College Goal Sunday lists its schedule on its website. Some states run similar seminars that go by different names. California has Cash for College. I dropped in on a Cash for College event at Camino Nuevo High School in Los Angeles. The school's computer lab was packed with parents and students. Volunteers from a local college's financial aid office wore blue Cash for College t-shirts and shouted instructions from the center of the room.
How many of you already filled out your
Layla Fernandez dragged her brother Derek to the workshop. She's had to nag him about college paperwork every step of the way.
Now his concern is more like, are we going to have enough money? So that's one of the reasons I'm here, because yes, there is money. Just need to learn how to look for it.
For Derek, the payoff isn't just the money.
I've never had that mentality of like seeing myself in college, because I grew up like not really motivated of going to school and everything. But like coming here and seeing these opportunities is something like great.
Camino Nuevo principal Scott Weatherford says the school works really hard to get kids into college, but finances can derail those plans. Many of his students come from bilingual backgrounds and have parents with low-paying jobs. This is the demographic that has the toughest time making it to college.
You know, last year 80% of our students were accepted to four-year university, which is a great number, but then the next step is making sure that those students can all pay for college as well.
And filling out the federal application for financial aid can be really overwhelming, but less overwhelming than it used to be. The Department of Education has taken the online FAFSA form from 26 pages down to 9. It's easier to skip past questions that might not relate to you, like the section on homelessness or military service, and your answers are used to prompt only relevant follow-up questions. Soon, you'll also be able to import tax information directly from the IRS website onto the financial aid form. Justin Draeger is with the National Association of Student Financial Aid Administrators. He says students used to have to supply countless forms to prove their financial need.
Higher education and advocates for student aid were using a lot of data to narrow in on the students who most needed limited financial resources that the federal government was offering.
But then the Department of Education realized the approach was backfiring.
The complexity of the form and the process may have been discouraging many students, and especially low-income students, from actually ever filling out the financial aid application, receiving the federal student aid that they need to go to college.
A recent study showed that low-income students who received help filling out their financial aid forms were significantly more likely to attend college.
For parents, if you don't have a place to sit...
Victor Gonzalez came to the Cash for College event with his son Vladimir to get some of that guidance.
For me, this workshop, they just gave it to us. It's really helpful because I didn't know nothing about it.
His son wants to attend a four-year university to study engineering. If he doesn't get enough grants, he'll have to go to a community college.
Like, because, I mean, not that community college is bad, but if I have the opportunity to go to, like, to get a bigger education, like, I would take it, but it's just I need the money, so.
Despite the bad economy and deep budget cuts, there is more government aid available this year. Federal Pell Grants are higher than they've ever been, $5,550 per student. Interest rates on subsidized Stafford loans have dropped by 1%, and there are tuition tax credits available. Mark Kantrowitz is the publisher of the website finaid.org. He says that's good news because the demand for money is at record levels.
So far this year, the number of FAFSAs submitted is up 20% year over year, and that's after a 12% increase the year before, which was itself a record.
Students who want financial aid will need to file their federal forms by June, but everyone I spoke to had one piece of advice.
To apply early.
Start early.
I would say do it early.
And you know what early means? Now. In Los Angeles, I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace Money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Nightly Business Report on PBS, presenting Your Mind and Your Money, a series looking at psychological factors that can lead investors to make mistakes. Mondays on Nightly Business Report on PBS stations. And by LendingTree.com, offering the new Loan Coach, giving personalized financial advice for every step of the lending process. Just one of the many tools at the all-new LendingTree.com. And by Constant Contact, helping small businesses stay connected to their customers with email marketing, online surveys, and event marketing. Over 300,000 small businesses and nonprofits use ConstantContact.com.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Jane Bryant Quinn has been teaching all of us how to better manage our money for the better part of three decades. She's written on personal finance for The Washington Post, Newsweek, Bloomberg. Quinn's classic bestseller, Making the Most of Your Money Now, debuted in 1991. It is a financial management Bible and about as big as the King James. A new edition's just been published, taking into account the economic crisis and Great Recession we're all living through. She recently visited our studios here in Los Angeles to talk about it. Well, Jane Bryant Quinn, it is such a pleasure to meet you in person. I grew up seeing your photo in the back of Newsweek, and I got to tell you, I wish that my parents had made me read it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. So I know that there is no money-back guarantee on your book, but if I read all, let's see, shall we do this? 1,190 pages.
That's right. There is everything you want to know is in that book.
Well, then, will I, more importantly, be rich if I read it all?
Well, you will avoid being poor. Let's start with that one.
Good enough. We all do want that quick fix, don't we?
We want that quick fix. This is more get rich slowly.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. So you wrote this book originally in 1991. Recessionary times, much like we're in now. In fact, even a housing bust here in California. Does it make you wonder if anybody read your book, since we are repeating so many mistakes over and over and over again?
People are coming around to some of the old-fashioned ideas that say, I need to save more money. Home equity loans won't work anymore because there's not any home equity. The way I build equity is to pay down my mortgage. What a concept. One thing that really worries me a lot, and you can see all around you what has happened, is that credit card debt has come to be normal. But credit card debt isn't normal. Consumer debt is pure waste. What has happened is that as people get older, they move to sort of middle age, beyond middle age, it used to be they would get rid of their debt then. But now they are still carrying consumer debt. And when your paycheck stops, you are cooked if you have all of this debt. So younger people need to say, I don't want this to happen to me, which means you need to save earlier and you just need to quit with these 20% interest rates. Well, I mean, adding 20% to everything you buy is ridiculous.
It certainly is, especially when you might be clipping coupons at the same
time.
That's
right. You're living paycheck to paycheck, and yet all this is slipping through your fingers. And I remember this happened to me once. I was living paycheck to paycheck. I was in my early 20s, and I wasn't saving a dime. And a friend came by, the company I worked for at the time, and said, was I contributing to the thrift plan? And I said, no, I can't pay the dentist. How could I save money?
Wait, but you're Jane Bryant Quinn.
I wasn't then. I was 21 years old and learning. So he called me. Actually, he called me an idiot was what he called me, and said I should start putting money into the thrift plan. And so with fear and trembling, I took 5% of my paycheck and put it in. And you know what happened? Nothing happened.
Didn't miss
it. My life didn't change. Yeah. I still couldn't pay the dentist. I was living the way I was living before, but I was suddenly saving 5%. And I went to 7%. I went up to 10%. And it still didn't change my life.
Well, you know, you talk about common sense, and I think you're probably more familiar than just about anyone with kind of the rules of personal finance. Do you think that any of the tenets, the basic rules, have changed out of this financial crisis?
I do not think so. I think that what is happening is that people are gaining a new appreciation of the basic rules, which they had previously ignored. If you think in terms of mortgages, for example, an interest-only mortgage was always insane.
Right.
But now you have to put a down payment. This is an old rule. Save some money, have a down payment, and then start paying off your mortgage. So that is that was not what we did for the past 10 years, right? So there's one thing that's an old rule that makes sense that now people are looking at. In terms of the stock market, people have been trying to buy individual stocks. That is ridiculous. What do you or I know about what is going on inside a particular company? Look at the people, Citibank, a widows and orphans stock, supposedly.
Mm-hmm.
And it crashes. Don't buy stocks. by mutual funds, and furthermore, by index mutual funds that follow the market as a whole.
You know, I wonder where you think the fault lies with so many of the mistakes that we all make, whether it's getting caught up in a dot-com bubble or a housing bubble or what have you. Is this a matter of financial education at a young age? How is it that we get to the point where so many people are so confused about what's right and wrong in personal finance?
I very strongly believe that we should have some kind of personal finance education in high school, you know, at least a semester of things like credit cards and to tell kids that credit histories exist and the basics of personal finance. We should do that in every single high school. Then, of course, I have a little book that they can read, which or a big book they can read, which tells them all about it.
Yeah.
But there's some responsibility on the other side, too. I know we need to be responsible for ourselves and we need to learn how to do this. And you can't just hand your money to someone else and say, okay, it's up to you, and then mm-hmm. walk away and then be surprised if something goes wrong. But I also feel very strongly about this deregulation that has taken place of the financial industry, mm. that with stronger regulations, better disclosures, better requirements would give consumers something at least to help them with when they're faced with these so-called experts that are going to mislead them. If an agency like that were passed, you would be able to do something about things that are simply unsafe products. For example, these exploding mortgages yeah. that everybody got stuck with. They should not have been on the market in the first place. And there are other products that would benefit from someone saying, you know, you've got to disclose this, you have to tell people this, you can't hide this, and it's got to be right up front. And I think that would help people.
In a moment, we continue our conversation with the doyen of dollars, Jane Bryant Quinn, and we'll get her take on whether we all make keeping our finances in order a little harder than it needs to be. That's coming up after the break on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. And now back to our conversation with personal finance icon Jane Bryant Quinn. Her classic book, Making the Most of Your Money Now, has just been reissued with an eye toward what's changed or not out of the financial crisis. You know, so many people were hurt by this downturn. Lots of them who believed, perhaps rightly, that they were doing everything right. They got responsible mortgages. They diversified their investments, and they still ended up taking a big hit. What do you say to those folks?
How big a hit you took in the stock market depended on what percentage of your money you had in the stock market. And if you had it all there, that was a mistake. It shouldn't mm-hmm. have all been there. You need an appropriate division between stock funds and bond funds, depending on your age. So if you were 50, 55, 60, you should have had probably less money in stocks than you actually had. And if you had more bonds and fewer stocks, you would not have been hit as hard. So one of the lessons to learn is that it's very important that you have a balance between stocks and bonds that are appropriate for your age.
What about outside of the market? I guess what I'm trying to tap into here is the anger that is out there. You know, you have the person who got the 30-year fixed mortgage, has been making their payments, and yet now they're stuck in a neighborhood where there are foreclosures all around them. And at the same time, perhaps they are being asked to pony up to help banks that gave out those bad mortgages. And they have also lost, you know, property value. And, you know, people look around and say, you know, why should I pay any sort of price for the bad decision that my neighbor made?
Because if you are not that way, then our country will never be repaired.
Hmm.
You can say, don't save the banks. Fine, don't save the banks. And then we would be in 1933 at this moment. You can say, don't help my neighbor with the mortgage. And fine, it forecloses, the house is a mess. And now, you know, it's hurt you even more. And truly, if you simply think that way, Our country cannot be repaired. You have to say, by saving other people, I am also saving myself.
You touched on this a little bit before, but I did want to ask you, do you think it's hard to conquer personal finance? Or do we make it harder than it should be?
Personal finance isn't hard. It is basically common sense. And if you do the simple things, you know, put a down payment on your mortgage, pay your bills on time, don't stretch them out, don't have too many credit cards. There is nothing hard about that. As long as you just say to yourself, all this other stuff I read about, the hedge funds and the this and the that, you don't need any of that stuff. It is expensive. It will make your broker rich. It will not make you rich. And I don't use any of that stuff. And I have come to it. Learned mm-hmm. by investing in an oil well that was dry. I mean, I've been there. I've done it.
Oh, you did not.
I did.
Jane Bryant Quinn is the author of Making the Most of Your Money Now. In its, what edition are we on now?
It's the third edition. And I am also posting new material on my website, janebryantquinn.com.
Where you are blogging and tweeting, you told me.
I certainly am.
Thank you so much for coming in. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. This has been fun.
And we heard earlier from Jane that credit card debt is not normal, but lots of us still have it and still struggle with it. New laws go into effect later this month that are supposed to help us in that struggle. We want your opinions about the new regulations and whether they'll have any impact on your behavior. Write to us at marketplace.org. It's time to grab your piggy bank and drop your 2 cents in as we talk about your life with dollar signs this week. And here with me to do that is our expert of the week. You like that title?
I like that. I don't have enough dollar signs, but I got a lot of expertise.
That is David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times. And we should also credit you with life with dollar signs.
Thank you. All right. I thought that was just going to be kind of one of those unsung hero things.
We promise if we put it on a t-shirt that you'll get a cut. How's that?
My kid will go to college. Thank God.
All right. Now, David, we're going to talk to Tessie in Los Angeles, and we don't mean me. It's always funny to talk to someone else with my name because it's kind of unusual.
Yes, that's my experience as well.
Well, I understand that just like the rest of us, you get scams in your email all the time. That means perhaps we need a better spam filter. But tell us a little bit about what you got. This was not a letter from a Nigerian banker, I hope.
That's right. I have gotten those many times before. And of course, you know to ignore those. But this one was very unusual because it referred me to a PDF and then it looks very corporate. It has the Texaco logo, and it refers to me as a job candidate, mm-hmm. offers me a job with Downstream Europe Services. And
had you asked them for a job? Had you applied online or anything like that?
No, this isn't
out
my industry. It's not my line of work at all. So.
Wow.
However, it doesn't ask me for any money. It asks me for a little bit of information, but not anything that I would consider really dangerous. And then it refers me to a couple of websites that indeed seem to be the Texaco websites. So I was kind of surprised.
Well, now you emailed us this attachment and we've asked David to take a look at it. Have you put it through your, scam-o-meter?
Tess, let me ask you a question. Did you post your resume online at one of the job sites?
Yeah, I have posted it on Monster before.
Let me tell you what happened, and here's the scam. What these scammers did was they found your resume online, and that's why it says on the letter you received, ostensibly from Texaco, that we wish to inform you that your posted information online has been carefully and confidentially reviewed, and we're going to offer you a job. So they're telling you right there that...
They went on Monster.com,
We've
too.
Seen your resume, and we like what we see, even though you don't have a lick of experience in the oil industry. You're our kind of worker, and they're liking that. Now, what's fascinating, and I think particularly insidious about this scam, is the way they're preying on you, the job seeker, as opposed to a greedy individual who loves the idea that an African dictator wants to put millions of dollars into your bank account, which astonishingly people fall for every day.
It is astonishing, isn't it?
It's amazing.
How does this still happen?
I've talked to the Federal Trade Commission. They're even flummoxed that it's so successful, but it is.
Wow.
Anyway, Tess, so here's what happened to you. You get this letter that basically says, we love you. We want to offer you a job. They want to know your name. They want to know your education experience, your job interest, and your current position. This is pretty benign stuff. What's really impressive about this scam is they're going to carry it out another level, because when you look down the letter, you come all the way down, and here's where the hook is now being offered. There are two links on this letter, as you've seen, Tess, and one of them, which you no doubt clicked on, will take you to a legitimate Texaco.com site. Now, this is a complete red herring. If you go there, it has nothing to do with anything. All it does is adds a little more legitimacy to what they're doing. The real catch, and the only clue that you're being given that there's something amiss here, is the email address. In the very last line of the letter, it says, for further details relating to your employment, kindly send an email to Texaco Chevron Downstream Europe Recruitment Service Department at texaco@post.com.
Texaco at Post.
Hello, post.com. Now, this should be recruitment at texaco.com.
Right.
And I didn't click on that one.
Here's what would happen if you did click on that, is you would click on that and you'd say, I got your letter and I'm interested in knowing more. And when you do that, I guarantee you will receive a response from someone saying that he works for Texaco that's going to take this to the next level.
And it's going to have your request for your Social Security number.
I guarantee you there will be a request for your social in the next step.
Interesting.
Don't go there.
All right. There you go, Tessie. So it sounds like you did the right thing and just steered clear of this. But thanks for flagging it for us.
Sure. Now it's back to Craigslist for me.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Well, Virginia in St. Paul is also worried about some scams. She's looking to sell some gold jewelry. Boy, I've been hearing a lot about this lately, but she doesn't want to get ripped off, right, Virginia?
That's correct.
You got a lot of old jewelry laying around there?
Well, not a lot, but enough that I'm not going to use, and I thought I'd turn it into some cash if I could.
So why are you wanting to sell?
Well, I have a trip I want to make. My sister's turning 50, and she's invited a family to come to Rome, and I don't want to go into debt to do that.
Wow. How did Rome become the destination here?
She's an artist and lives and works in Europe, and that's a place that they are fond of.
Well, David, there are all kinds of shady operations offering top price on gold and silver jewelry. Let's listen to one of the TV pitches that is pretty ubiquitous on the boob tube these days.
Get top dollar for your unwanted, broken, or mismatched jewelry. Because if you're selling, cashforgold.com is buying.
I sold my old jewelry and took the vacation of a lifetime.
Virginia, is that you?
Que bella.
The vacation of a lifetime.
You never know.
I don't know, David. Well, I see these kinds of advertisements, and I just want to run the other way.
These are shark-infested waters, Tess, and I advise people to be very careful. But that said, let's face it, gold is at sky-high levels, trading around $1,100 an ounce at the moment, mostly because of fears among the gold bugs and other investors that the economy is about to completely collapse,
right,
and the four horsemen are come riding in, locusts, plague, the works, and so they're
moving. And even with all that, you'll be able to buy stuff with gold, right?
Yeah, exactly. And because nevertheless, Fort Knox still in business, and so people who are into gold in a big way.
Well, is there anyone that Virginia can trust if she wants to go ahead and try to sell some of this gold so she can take this vacation?
I think, Virginia, you want to tiptoe a little bit here. What I would recommend is shop around to a few jewelry stores, because some of them do a secondary trade in buying and selling. Just kind of get a sense of what they're appraising your jewelry at. If you go to, say, three or four different jewelry stores and get an appraisal from each one, at some point you're going to get a sense of the market value. Be very wary, though, of these Ron Popeil style kind of things of gold, gold, Monday. Yeah. That's not what you want to be doing. That's not how you ever want to sell anything.
When you see MC Hammer and Ed McMahon telling you to bring in your gold.
Yeah, run for cover. Gary Coleman, you don't want to be there. But, you know, for you, this is Rome. So, you know, keep your eye on the ball.
Right.
Well, I'm envious. That'll just be a fabulous,
yeah,
fabulous
you toss
vacation.
A coin in the Trevi Fountain for us, okay?
I will. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye, Virginia.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. You can also send us an email at marketplace.org. David Lazarus of the Los Angeles Times, great to have you on the show again.
Always a pleasure.
And remember to always check with your financial professional before you make any big money decisions.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. It's pigskin party time. Get out the chips and guac. Maybe some colorful beads and jambalaya if you're a Saints fan, or something blue and white if you're a Colts fan. If you're a betting fan, you know the Colts have been favored by line setters in Vegas since the final playoff round a couple of weeks ago. The Super Bowl is the biggest one-day sports gambling event of the year. So we thought we'd take this opportunity to find out what a Vegas pro thinks about the whole stock market as casino analogy. We reached John Avello at the Wynn Hotel in Las Vegas, where he runs the sports book, and we asked him whether he thought the odds were any better on Wall Street than where he works.
Probably not. Probably the bettors may have a little advantage in our world because you're laying maybe a little less of a juice, so to speak, vigorish.
What is that you just said?
The juice or the vigorish. In the world of stock betting or buying, you know, you have to pay a commission on your stock, and we also charge that in the race and sports book. The vigorish, or the juice, as we call it, that is a commission that the race and sports book takes. For every $100 you bet, we charge 10%. So let's take a Super Bowl, for instance. If two teams and you were going to take the favorite and lay 6 points, you would lay 110 to win 100. And if you won that bet, you would get back 210. Well, the losers, we get to keep their money, and the winners get it back. And that's how we make our money in Las Vegas sports books.
So would that be like the fees in my 401k?
It's a lot less than those fees, and you really should look at those close.
So do you invest in the stock market? Have any of your retirement money in there?
Yes, I do. And things were looking pretty good for a while, and all of a sudden, they're not looking as favorable.
Yeah, so what does a Vegas bookmaker invest in?
For me, it's not about trying to select individual stocks. For me, it's more of the mutual funds for long term, you know. And I've always been a believer on let the money work and be spread out and don't have to worry about administrating, you know, individual stocks.
Well, could I ask you to lay odds on a couple of things that we here at Marketplace Money are watching kind of closely these days? I promise I won't hold you to it.
That's okay. Let's do it.
All right. Healthcare reform, the odds of it happening this year?
Healthcare reform, I'm going to say the odds of it happening this year are probably 6-5 against. Last year I would have laid probably 1-2 that it would happen.
And what about financial reform, making sure we don't get into another mess with the banks? Is that ever going to happen?
This year, yes. Long term, I'm not so sure. So for this year, I'll make that a pretty good favorite.
And what about this credit card legislation that's going to go into effect in a couple of weeks here? Want to bet that it'll really have any long-term effect on the credit card companies?
In the short term, I would probably make it 8-1 that it won't succeed, only because it's going to take a little while for everyone to get used to. The economy will still be weak. The consumers don't really have a lot of alternatives. In the long term, I would make it a favorite at 2-3, hopefully, that we will have learned our lessons and things have stabilized. And, you know, that's certainly wishful thinking. And won't work at all. I'd probably make 2-1. And that's because we may just get complacent and go back to our old habits again.
And finally, have you put a line out yet on the Red Sox winning the World Series this year?
Oh, yes. The Red Sox to win the World Series has been up, let's see, what's it been, 3 months or so?
So they're going to take it all, right?
Yeah. Well, there's a team in the East Coast who has something to say about that test.
Uh-oh. You're from New York, right?
Yeah, yes, I am. And the Red Sox to win the World Series next year are 7-1. And what that means, for every dollar that you would put up, you would win 7. If you're interested, Tess, I'm here in Nevada with open arms waiting for you.
All right, I think it's about a 3-hour drive, so I'll see you in a bit.
Okay.
By the way, he's picking Avatar to win its title match at the Oscars next month. And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, annuities. Now, before you nod off to sleep, there is a reason we're going there.
I don't know if they'll ever be sexy, but, you know, the president and his crew are talking them up and, you know, they're on the radar screen again.
Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Troh. Our technical director is Josh Rogerson. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again. Marketplace Money is supported by Putnam Investments, offering new ways for investors to pursue their goals with lower volatility on the web at putnam.com/absolute return.
American Public Media.